Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 20th, 2001. In the Creekside Room this morning are Carol Osterlund and Robert Sellers. Today's session number is OSC 2001-4, and it's titled Exploring Life Stories, The Creative Path of Memoir and Poetry. This is the fourth session in the series being done for Elder Hostel. Let's listen in.
Poetry exists in all prose. You know, it's the basis. And first of all, I want to find out, we took your Holden spirit that you all wrote and put it on our computer. So what we're going to do today is pass this around. You can find the one you wrote. If it's okay, just put a check mark by it. And then tomorrow, and then if you haven't, I got another one handed in this morning, and I didn't get any from Minna, who started it all. We'd like something from you if you feel like sharing and having it go to our director. So anyway, what I'm going to do is pass it around. If you don't, and I have one here, if it's all right, just put a check mark after it, and then we'll redo it tonight, and then tomorrow I'm going to bring it back, the completed one, and I want you to sign your name by yours. So... That's the idea. Okay? So we'll start it over here.
And if you didn't write something yesterday, you'll care to write it on the back of it.
Yeah, and if you haven't written anything when it comes to you, because we've got all morning, the rest of the morning, write something on the back as it comes by, or write something during class and hand it to me.
Yeah, we've got two already.
Yeah, so then we'll be able to do it on the back. Mm-hmm. Oh, Minna has one. Okay.
But you may not be able to read my handwriting.
Oh, I'm sure we can.
I don't cross the T's.
Okay.
I put a doodle on it.
All right. Now, did anybody else do any of the other assignments? Do you have Indian names to talk about? Or anything else from that?
Who was it?
Okay, let's do that a little later, because I'll do the Indian names right now. Did anybody do the Indian?
Mm-hmm.
I know Patrice. Yeah, over here.
You mean that one? My
one? Yeah, your one.
Yeah. What I asked yesterday was that if one of the handout sheets, and we talked about it a little bit, since we're in this, you know, with nature all this week, if you could be, give yourself an Indian name or any kind of word that would describe you. To tell us what it might be and write a little something about why or how you feel about that. Did you did one? Would you share it?
It's terrible.
No judgment.
How dare we? My English teacher in college said that my poetry was the worst she'd ever heard.
Okay, I think you may have missed your calling, because that's what it takes to really be a good poet.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the word for Brooke in Indian, but that's what it would be.
Okay.
A brook is loving as it mends and nourishes the soil and plants on its way. A brook which seeks out new paths for learning and yet maintains its flow day by day. A brook whose music brings a song to our hearts and accompanies the voices that nature imparts. the other voices that make him press. A brook whose loving beauty and pleasure can in some way join others to bless all forever.
Well, my name is Smiling Flea.
I always said my
only talent in this world was a smile.
She said Smiling Flea. And how did you?
I don't know quite how I came by Flea, but my only talent in this world is a smile.
Thank you.
I have an arthritic problem, so my name is Wounded Knee.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I got an infected toe here, so I'm stumbling bear.
Writing stories about the things in your drawer, or things that you lost, or going into a thrift shop and making up poems or stories about things. All of these things should spur you. And this is what we need to do, is just keep looking for ways that we can express our response to the world. Because the more we know about ourselves, the more we really can know each other. I guess I'll share what I wrote. I wrote this early this morning. I thought about it at 2 in the morning. My name is Laughing Stream. I dance down mountain slope, rush past sleeping stones, call birch branch, yellow leaf to join my journey. In quiet pools of solitude, fish spawn new dreams. I become one with river flow, then rest in warm currents on far seas. Until, reborn, I rise to white cloud, dance with rain on new green hill, and my name is Laughing Stream. And then this has gone around, just old business. If you haven't signed it yet and you want us to mail you one of the personal journaling, just come up afterwards and check off your name or raise your hand here if you...
Or add your name if you're not
old. Yeah, or add your name. Anybody need to add that? And then I have one other bit of old business. Somebody that first day asked me for a copy of the poem I read about Taffy Jo Clark and wanted a copy. So,
thank you.
Okay. In an antique bookstore, which I frequent, you know, whenever I can find one, I came across a volume of poetry, and I wish I had bought it, because I've always been haunted by the name of the book. And maybe some of you might recognize it, because I never did, but I always remember the title. And I'm sure it was written somewhere around 1915. And the name of the title was Nets to Catch the Wind. And I thought that was the most beautiful description of poetry, because, you know, you can't catch it. It's there and you try, you know, and I don't need to explain the metaphor, but that always intrigued me. So this is what we're doing today. Free verse to me, as I said informally as we just began, is the basis of all writing. When we go to the writers' conference every year, lots of times, although I write children's stories and I write prose, I still think of myself primarily as a poet, but I find that if I go to the poetry sessions, it becomes the basis for all my other writings. If I really let myself into the discipline of writing poetry, then when I write prose, I'm much more concise. I'm more able to find the right word. And then also, I think there is a music of all written words. And any good writing, if you read it aloud, it won't you won't stumble over it as you read it aloud. It will flow from your tongue, and it will have a rhythm and a beat to it. And this, to me, is what good writing is. And poetry teaches us how to do that. So, you know, I really urge you to, as I have all week, write and try writing the poetry. And I think many, and I know many of you have. And as I said earlier, you know, I remember my father reading aloud. How many of you still remember poems that you memorized as children?
Yes.
What's a few? Give us a few lines.
How do you like to go up in the air so high? Oh, yes. Oh, I think it's the most wondrous thing ever a child can do.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Oh, when Earth's last finger is painted and the tubes are twisted and dried.
You know,
how do the spreading chestnut tree the village yeah. Says?
Anybody else?
Whether you'll do it or cast it aside.
and you know, as you say this, you repeat the rhythm of it, you know. And I remember, of course, the day is done, the darkness falls on the wings of night as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in its flight. And that's the one that ends, and the night shall be filled with music, and the cares that infest the day will fold their tents like the Arabs and as silently steal away. But you know, it's not a bad discipline to memorize something new. If you, you know, just for the heck of it, just go ahead and find something you really enjoy and think about memorizing it. One time in junior high school, I actually memorized the whole Raven. You know, once upon a Nigeria, as I pondered weak and weary over many acquaintance fears, glad of a forgotten lore. And I got through it. And somebody in the back of the room, I think I was in eighth grade, said, "Wind her up again." And I got thinking how, you know, we need to be aware of the poetry in our life. And some of the most beautiful poetry is in our hymnals. And one of my favorites is one we sing every Christmas, and I'm not going to read it all because you know it, but if you just listen to it in a new way, and when you sing the hymn, really think of the words. I know we're all so busy trying to follow the melody sometimes, but think of the words. And this, of course, is by Philip Brooke, and it's absolutely one of my beautiful poems. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in the dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. And all, you know, all four verses are equally beautiful. And I think sometimes we sing them and we don't really realize the beautiful poetry that is the basis of it.
We had a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities. His name was Dr. Kaufmanis, and he was an astronomer. Mm-hmm. And he gave this wonderful presentation on the Christian scientist's view of the Bethlehem star. Uh-huh. And he said, I never thought much about that, Carol, but he had the theory about the three merging stars, you know, to make their planets. And when he gets to that verse, oh, morning stars together, then it became his favorite hymn, you know. Right.
Okay.
Oh,
morning stars together. Yeah, read that second verse for us. The second verse.
For Christ is born of Mary and gathered all above. While mortals sleep, the angels keep their watch of wondering love. Oh, morning stars, plural, together, proclaim the holy birth and praise the same to God the King and peace to all on earth.
Were there supposed to be three stars or something like that together?
Yeah, yeah.
Planets.
Yeah.
Planets.
Oh. And they foretold astrologically, they foretold
something of the very
significant.
Oh, yeah, I marked one other one just. Another beautiful one is, O Master, let me walk with you in lowly paths of service true. Teach, tell me your secret, help me bear the strain of toil, the fret of care. Teach me your patience, share with me a closer, dearer company in work that keeps faith sweet and strong, in trust that triumphs over wrong. I think came across this, and I'm sort of paraphrasing an article written by Stanley Kunitz, and it was from Poet Speak. And in Eskimo, the word to make poetry is the same word to breathe. Both are derivatives of A-N-E-R-C-A, anerca, I guess, or anersa, the soul, which is eternal, the breath of life. A poem is words infused with breath of spirit. Let me breathe on it, says the poet maker, and then begins, I have put my poem in order on the threshold of my tongue. A poem is at once the most primitive and most sophisticated use of language. It has its roots in magic and the spell over things delivered by the priest or shaman or the tribe. The words of a poem go back to the beginnings of the human adventure, when the first syllables were not spoken, but sung or chanted or danced. So it is that poetry always seems about to burst into song, to break into dance. Above all, poetry is intended for the ear. It must be felt to be understood, and before it can be felt, it must be heard. Poets listen for their poems, and we as readers must listen in turn. I think one of the sad things about the television generation is that everything is so visual. You know, for me, as I was saying, I grew up listening to the radio, and I learned in an auditory way. And I remember old dramas, like, I don't know if you ever listened to I Love a Mystery, or there was your imagination infused it with so much drama, and we listened, and we didn't need we didn't need to see it. We saw it. It didn't have to be there on a screen. And I think that nowadays you expect everything to be right there visually. And poetry really is auditory. You have to hear it. And when you write, read what you write out loud. See how it falls off your tongue. And practice. And when I write a poem, like I did that last night, I hear it in my head. I actually almost memorize a poem when I write it before I even put it on paper, because I've heard it in my head so long. And then I write the first draft, and then I rewrite it, but it comes out, the way I first heard it in my head. And so don't think of it being something that you're going to look at and visualize the printed words. You have to hear it. You have to sing it. And I sort of give you something to look at every day. And ask yourself, tell yourself, I am willing to let myself hear the music inside me.
Yeah. One thing, when you were talking about radio, One Man's Family. Boy, I had every character pictured. I knew what their life. Then they put it on TV, and they were so long.
This is the story of Father Barber and his bewildering offspring.
That old girl from the little mining town in the west.
Right. Can she find happiness as the wife of a wealthy, entitled Englishman? The Snyders are hurried down the aisle to their seats. There's the bell, and here's our play.
You see the fur coats.
Talk about our experience at the Writers' Conference listening to. It's terrible that we don't remember his name.
Oh! At the Writers' Conference, they always have rather important people or authors that know to lecture, but sometimes they just have somebody to lecture. So one night they scheduled a poet who I had, or Alfie Carroll had known or whatnot, but And he had an unbelievably bad experience getting from San Francisco to Santa Barbara by plane, so it was very late and people waited for him, and when he got there he was a black boy. And he was, you know, with the hair
all braided.
Braided, but he was in his 50s. And oh, I don't know. You begin to make a little judgment, then you say, don't make any judgment. Just listen.
Not by grace, but just by the way he was dressed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could have been anybody, but with a earring and the wild pants and, you know, leather jacket, you know, you just, it had nothing to do with color. It was more than...
But he started off by reading poems, and he moved with... Such rhythm is unbelievable. And he finally got so entranced into him. And then he told his story. He was a basketball player, almost good enough for the NBA, but not quite. So he went to Europe. And he went to Europe to play basketball, and this was all he knew. And then he hurt his knee. And he said, I've got to go back to the United States. I don't know what I want to do, so I'm going to learn poetry, which my mother had, we found that out later, had instilled in him that he could become a poet. But in Europe, all he knew was to pick up the old books, and it was all put down poetry. And of course, when he got back to the United States, nobody had any form of poetry. So he said, I didn't let that bother me. I just then went into free verse. But then I found that I could give poetry readings and read my poem. And I have learned in basketball that it's all in movement. And he moved.
He did. All the time. He was dancing the whole time. He was
thinking. You've seen the heart of Joe Potters and all of those people that how they move. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it was absolutely exhausting. I mean, it was absolutely beautiful. He was exhausted, but yet he said, usually I'm more animated than I am tonight. it was the most marvelous, beautiful thing to see because his whole body was involved in his poetry.
So eventually he said, I must read a poem about my mother. But first I want to tell you about my mother because she was such a wonderful influence in my life and so forth and so on. She's the only reason that I existed and got through East St. Louis, which is, you know. And he said, she insisted that I carry a book in my clothes, but I knew that I would be ridiculed, I would be punished, I would be beaten. They found it. I could be better off with a gun than having a book of poetry. And he had to hide it in his clothes. You know, they wanted to lose clothes so they could hide most everything. But he hid a book of poetry. And it was absolutely incredible.
So, get into your body, you know, all of your whole body. This is a wonderful book. Actually, I borrowed it from Diane Shire's library, but it's one I know. And if you're really serious about writing poetry, this is called Finding What You Did Not Lose. And I came across this poem, which I really like, and it's by a man named John Enright, who his logic teacher at Yale, the famous F.S.C. Northrop, gave John a grade of 98, telling him it was the highest grade he had given anyone in 20 years of teaching logic. John pursued the remaining 2% for many years, but he was glad he never found it. When John began to write poetry at the age of 64, it wasn't logic that seemed to matter anymore. He heard wilder voices. He began to face his mortality and to consider what he had missed when he measured logical existence. And this is his poem called Goodbye. How can I say goodbye to the places I have never been, to the magical lands I read of when young, the people, the scenes, the beasts that I dreamed of? I was new, and young world was beckoning. How can I say goodbye to the places I went, but wasn't? So caught up in fear and trying to impress, busy living out images dreamed by others, that nothing quite real, truly mine, was occurring. How can I say goodbye to people I never did meet, those I admired, since the chances of kinship, kept away by false images, fear, and unworthiness, so I never could take the first step? How can I say goodbye to those I did meet, but didn't let in? So full of conviction that they wouldn't see me, so fearful of what they might say, think, or do, that I kept all exchange on the surface. How can I say goodbye to those parts of me that never were used? The drummer, the hero, the magician, chief, yes, beggar and trickster, the juggler and thief, kept locked in my attic by fear or by grief. I think that's a remarkable point.
Who's the author of that book?
This is John Fox, and it's published by, it says an inner workbook, Jeremy P. Charger Putnam book, published by G.P. Putnam and Sons. I'm sure it's in most of the bookstores. It says the author is a certified poetry therapist and lecturer in the Graduate School of Psychology at the John F. Kennedy University in Orinda, California. And I have to share with you my favorite author, and he quotes them in here. And it does start out, it's not three verse, but it says something about poetry. And the first, and the poem begins, "What shall we do about poor little Tigger? He never eats nothing, he'll never get bigger. He doesn't like honey and acorns and thistles because of the taste and because of the bristles. And all the good things which an animal likes have the wrong sort of swallow or too many spikes. He's quite big enough anyhow," says Piglet. "He isn't really very big." "Well, he seems so." Pooh was thoughtful when he heard this, and then he murmured to himself, "But whatever his weight in pounds, shilling, and ounces, he always seems bigger because of his bounces." "And that's the whole point," he said. "Do you like it, Piglet?" "All except the shillings," said Piglet. "I don't think they ought to be there." "They wanted to come in after the pounds," explained Pooh. "So I let them. It's the best way to write poetry, letting things come." "Oh, I didn't know," said Piglet. You all need Pooh Bear? I recommend all the Pooh books to a child of any age, whether it's 7 or 85 or older, whatever. You know, read Pooh. You know, "The more it snows, tiddly-pom, the more it snows, tiddly-pom, the more it goes, tiddly-pom, on snowing. And nobody knows, tiddly-pom, nobody knows, tiddly-pom, how cold my nose, tiddly-pom, is growing." That's Pooh poetry.
I can read one.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this is the same. Life is Mary Oliver.
Who got the Pulitzer in, what was it, 1984?
I did.
Yeah.
But anyhow, in the same light as the first poem that Carol read, "The Summer Day, who made the world, who made the swan and the black bear, who made the grasshopper, this grasshopper I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaw back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Isn't that a lovely thing? What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Oh, yes. There's so many things I wish I'd written. So how do you write a poem? Well, this is from Lawrence J. Desner. He tells you how to write a poem. While you are actually writing your poem, you must never think about what you are doing. Never, until you have completed it, question whether it is good or not, whether readers will like it or understand it. While you are writing, you cannot think at all about anything. Put your pen in your hand, point it on the paper, start writing anything. Just keep on writing and focus on your subject. All you can do with your mind when you are writing is to say the words that are coming out of your pen. Before the pen starts to move and whenever it stops, concentrate all attention on your subject. You must roll your whole self up into a tight ball, as small as possible, and transport yourself into the moment of the very part of your being becomes a great big eye, an ear, and even nose. You become all skin and taste buds. You squeeze. The poem force comes from your pressure. Its direction is unpredictable. The process is called many things: meditation, composition, imagination. It is an intensified kind of paying attention. It is what people do under the pressure of love. It is the act of love and love's cause. The poet lover loses the sense of his own personal identity. So thoroughly does he identify with the subject, he becomes what he sings. It always works. What fails is the quality and concentration of your attention. That's why you must never think about the poem while you are writing. It's not hard to do this. All it takes is faith and courage. You need faith in the process itself and the courage to let yourself go. Courage to let your identity disappear into your subject. You cannot be afraid that the result will be embarrassing. It can be frightening to relinquish control over what comes out of you, but the effort is worth it. This is one of mine that I probably had. It was a second place winner in the National Portrait Contest, and I think it probably won a prize because it's probably one of the most original poems I ever wrote. The idea haunted me for a long time before I finally got it down. And it's, you know, really very simple. It's called Lines Across the Lawn. I shall find a small house by a well-used road. Families will pass on their way to the lake. Gray-haired couples smile and wave from long motor homes. Miles down the highway, the signs will begin. Poetry, 5 miles. Quatrains, just ahead. Laugh at limericks. Sonnets, special price. Like Grandma Moses showed her paintings, I will display my poems pinned to clotheslines. that stretch across the expanse of lawn. Patterns of words, billowing messages, like those stitched into antique quilts. I will sit on the front porch, watch everyone walk up and down reading my lines. A few will buy a page to place under butterfly magnets on a refrigerator door, mail to a friend, or tuck in a book. I will sip lemonade, offer coffee or a cold drink, write a quick verse for a child who celebrates a birthday. No one will hurry away. We will visit, discuss weather, a buried dream, or sudden flash of memory. At dusk, after I close the gate, I shall gather my poems like laundry in a basket, read them again, discover what prayers each has offered, dancing all day on the wheel of wind. Wouldn't that be a nice life? I'm going to stop just a minute, and I know you said that you had some of your memoirs that you, something that you had written that you would like to share. Yeah, yeah, we won't, you know.
If it's wrong, you can stop.
No, I just say, yeah, probably just read a page, you know.
Yeah. I get started.
Uh-huh.
Robert Schroeder broke into the subject. I wrote a history of my family this past year and gave it to them for Christmas, and it was quite a complete history in chapters. And since I finished it, I realized that it would be interesting to write to them, for them, where I have lived over my years. And I got started yesterday an inspiration in this class. I seldom ride through the hilly neighborhood of East Central Seattle that I don't pass the spot nostalgically where my parents brought me from Swedish Hospital to the two-story flat where I would spend the beginning 5 years of the first 86 years of my life. I'm looking forward to the rest after many residences here and away in the Pacific in a 19-story retirement community, coincidentally only a short distance from my first home. First Hill, the area is called, as that is where Seattle got much of its start. I remember little about the inside of the rectangular flat, except for a high brown chest. Maybe it was a freestanding wardrobe near the large kitchen where my dad stored his leather razor strap. That's indelible in my memory, as my gentle dad, who could do more with an accusing look in the spot of the hand, once threatened to get the strap down from the top and use it on me for something I undoubtedly deserved. Several times in later years, I passed the squared-off, unimaginative structure and remember it well while comparing it to another flat still standing on the east side of 11th Avenue near Madison Street. That is just a block from the east side of 11th Avenue near Park Street, where my flat was located. An empty hole now marks where I lived as the flat disappeared a few years ago and the land awaits the developer. The Pinto family lived in the flat's other apartment. I played with Harry, their first son, who was my age, and Neil must have followed him the 5 years we were there, and Doris must have joined her brother after we left. But we kept in touch, and I visited the Pintos in Mountain View, California in 1938 when I graduated from the university and before Harry endured the baton death march of the World War II, which he survived. Harry and I celebrated the ending of World War I by riding back and forth on 11th Avenue waving American flags as we rode our kitty cars back and forth. Kitty cars that mothers had decorated with red, white, and blue crepe paper streamers. I also have a lasting memory of Harry in the three stitches on my left hand middle finger inflicted when I chased him through his parents' apartment and he slammed the door before me, catching the finger in the door jam. I also included, this was the time when I learned to sing Cuckoo-Cuckoo-Katie, and over there.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, that's nice.
Wait, Anybody like to respond to her? Just, yeah, your images were, you know, really clear. I love the kids on the kiddie car ride, you know, waving their flags and, you know, the innocents following war.
I love the name Harry Pinto.
Yeah, you really can't make up names like that.
No.
And it really sounded so real. And thank you. Yeah. Does anybody else? Yeah.
Are other people able to read their reflections?
By all means.
Let's take about 2 minutes.
Sure. That's going to be my next question. Who else has something to read?
I like haiku. And so I got this idea of taking a haiku and then expanding on it. This was a haiku I wrote in about 1975. Like trapeze artists flying through time and space, we almost passed by. Mm-hmm. Holden Village, you almost passed by. How does a NASA discover a Lutheran retreat? Your daughter, you almost passed by and were not born. You arrived after 16 years of marriage, followed by a pilgrimage of disbelievers. 30 years of teaching, you hung like a spider on a thread as I struggled through full-time student and half-time wage earner. Affluenza, and that's the term that John has coined, which is a great video. Affluenza, you have passed by for 38 years. I was periodically attacked by your fever. A new life, you are passing into view, filled with feeding street people, hiring the poor and the homeless, with Jeff by my side.
Thank you. That's an interesting way to do it, to, you know, to write any kind of a form of poem, and then, you know, take the lines and you know, describe what the feeling that you're doing from that.
I did that for Christmas letter one time.
Yeah.
Take a haiku and then... Uh-huh. Then expand on that haiku, and then take another haiku and expand on that one.
Can you tell us what haiku means?
Oh, yeah. Actually, tomorrow we're going to do, you know, if you're interested at all, I'd like to at least touch a little bit on form poetry. Haiku is 5 syllables, 7 syllables, and we'll do it this tomorrow, and I'll give you examples. It's 5, 7, 5. Mm-hmm. Although nowadays, as I was saying yesterday, they're really letting you get away with not being that strict. What it mainly is just a little tiny poem of these 17 syllables or less that is a flash of insight. You know, it's just like a moment that you get this, the best way to describe it is it's just a little flash of some perception. And there's some really beautiful haiku being written. So we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. And I love some of the other Oriental Asian forms like the Sijo and Sinkane. Well, that's not Sinkane, isn't Asian, of course, or Korean, but the Korean is Sijo, and then, but there's a lot of short forms that, if you want to be a little bit disciplined in your approach to poetry, they're fun to work with. And of course, you have to love to play with words like I do. I love palindromes. Do any of you like palindromes?
What is that?
Palindrome is where it spells the same forwards or backwards.
Mm.
One of my favorites is...
That's
right.
I read it.
Oh, that's good.
Anis?
What
is it?
It's Edna. Sin. See? And if you do it backwards, it's D-E-N-N-I-S-A-N-D-E-D-N-A-S-I-N-N-E-D.
What is that, Poisonwood Bible, where she knows?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, simple ones like no part strap on.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's the old classic one, Napoleon, you know, Abel was I ere I saw Elba.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, in the Garden of Eden, Madam, I'm Adam. These are all palindromes. As I say, I love to play with words. In fact, here's a poem by Merwin, W.S. Merwin. This one is interesting. Oh, I didn't want to stop. Was there anybody else that had something to share? I sort of got off. Because I don't want to... Minna?
I did write a little thing, but it's not poetry.
No, it's all poetry.
Wait and see. I call it the psychologist. When my children were about 2 and 4, my daughter went to preschool, leaving her younger brother to wonder what school was like. Often they played school, my daughter being the teacher, and her younger brother the student body. Everything went fine until my daughter called to me quite annoyed. Mom, Paul is still calling me teacher, and we are not playing school anymore. Well, I said, why don't you tell him what you want him to call you? But I can't think of anything, she thought. Quick thinking on my part, I remembered a character from a children's TV show they had recently watched. Why don't you tell him to call you Jeremiah? They both laughed, and peace seemed restored. Patting myself on the shoulder for being such a remarkable psychologist, I left the two to their play, but just as I turned a corner, I heard my son scorn. Jeremiah. That's a funny name for a teacher.
And actually, you know, it's great, leaving it in prose. Many times the poem really, in fact, most of the poems I write really do like a story, have a beginning and a middle and an end. And you sort of, you don't ever really want to sum up or get preachy at the end of a poem, but there is a conclusion in just the way that your last line there, if you just took out, you know, if you just sort of took some of your key lines and arranged them in different shorter line lengths and ended with that last line, you really have a very wonderful glimpse of your... But, you know, I'm not telling you to do it. I'm only using it as an example that there's lots of ways you can write your memories or your feelings.
I want to hear a few quotes from my grandchildren.
Yes. No, we need them.
Quotes from grandchildren and alternate words. Our oldest grandchild, Alyssa, was a precocious child, of course, and often asked questions that prompted stories and comments with a moral or a punchline at the end. She went through a phase at about age 4 when she thought the word indeed was really cool, or seemed to indicate profound thought. So one day, out of the blue, she said to me, Grandma Kate, my dad says I'm skinny. Well, I replied with what I thought was a wise grandmotherly remark, well, Allie, you're a little girl, you're supposed to be skinny. Lots of girls are. And she thought for a while, and she hesitated as if not sure she should continue, and finally she went on, but Grandma, you're a girl, and you're not skinny. You're fat, very fat, indeed. Jake, at about age 5, had witnessed the illness, death, wake, funeral service, and burial of a great aunt. A deep thinker always, and very compassionate little boy, he was afraid that the casket would fall into the dugout grave too soon, or that people would walk on Aunt Beatrice's face after the dirt was replaced. But after careful consideration of that whole sequence of events that week, he wisely observed, well, I don't know about that die part, but wasn't that a really nice bed? His funeral was at a little Norwegian Lutheran church in rural Minnesota called Ringsaker. You've got to remember that. Ringsaker Lutheran. At the end of the service, the sexton told the age of Aunt Leitris as we were all filing out. Jake kept looking around expectantly as if things weren't done, and he piped up, well, they rang the bell. Aren't we going to play soccer? At another time in his pre-kindergarten youth, he went into a public restroom that used blue toilet cleaner and stools, and he came out with a surprised and pleased expression on his face. We all showed our deep appreciation of his experience when he announced, did you guys know that blue and yellow make green? Alan Jones' sister, Lexi, in her early years, had a way of using words that were almost right, like the planet uterus, but not quite. When we were playing Go Fish or Crazy Eight, she'd always ask, "Grandma, will you please flush the cards?" And she inquired, "Are you going to wear your gravy blue sweatshirt today?" After we had been substitute parents for those siblings and their one-year-old brother for 7 weeks this past summer, there were days when we were all on the ragged edge of a blow-up. It was a hot, humid day. Mosquitoes were biting, and Lexi had been pretty rude and disrespectful all day. She cleared the air with her poignant inquiry, "Did you remember that my folks don't believe in spanking?" And I pictures most kids in here.
This is called letting go. We said goodbye last month to our dining room table. For 35 years, it has graced our lives. It's been the center of our feastings, but also a place to do high school homework, wrap Christmas gifts, design a bridal gown, and scribble in color books. I think I will miss it as much as I miss our big maple tree that provided shade to our house each summer, and each fall filled our windows with yellow leaves so bright that the room seemed to glow like gold. A tornado took our tree from us. We gave our table away. We bought the table and its six matching chairs in the late 60s for $50 from Mrs. B., a gentle lady who was downsizing to a tiny apartment. Her daughter-in-law could not be bothered with her old things. But we were thrilled to own the table. Its walnut wood gleamed under our dining room light. Our children loved to trace with their fingers the carved flowers that trimmed the edge, and they played house underneath, the six sturdy legs marking out their rooms. Friends gathered round it time and again for coffee and cookies or candlelit dinners. The Nelson family crowded around it every Easter for a feast. We taught, a Bible study group met around it for many years. We taught our children which fork to use and how to use a cloth napkin neatly, or at special family meals. Once the kids served us a surprise dinner with the help of the teenager next door, complete with the best china and silver and a flaming dessert in our old cracked kitchen bowls. Three times it bore the gifts of food brought to feed our loved ones when my mother died, then my father, and earlier our son. But our most cherished times around the table were on Christmas Eve every year. The china and silver, the red glasses, the glowing candles, the same Norwegian menu, and always before we could eat, a photo of the family around the table. Those photos have become a treasured record of how we changed in looks and in number as one and then another child moved out or came back. At the time we purchased the table, close friends bought the matching buffet since we had no space or use for it. Their lives changed and so have ours, and when they decided it was time to build a smaller retirement home, we all agreed that the table, its chairs, and its matching buffet needed to be reunited with Mrs. B's family. Amazingly, we located her grandson, who recently retired in Minnesota, and he came to see for himself this furniture he had assumed was long lost. The day before the grandson came to claim the table, it is now, by the way, gracing his granddaughter's home, I said my private goodbyes. There were tears and a lump in my throat as I stood stroking the table. So I prayed for the table, that it will continue to know the joy of being loved and valued as it provides a place for a family to gather. There is pain in letting go, whether it's a tree or a table or a child. I must try to do it with gratitude and trust that God will help me make the transition. I know that one of these years it will be time to let go of our home or someone.
That's an absolutely marvelous thing to do, is to take, you know, one thing and expand on it. And you made it so real, and you felt the panorama of the years and all the things that happened. And it was something we could all identify with. Mm-hmm. You know, there were parts of it that, you know, I'm sure there was something in that each of us would identify with. You know, we had such a table. My favorite story about my father, whom I really admired. In 1935, we moved to San Jose, and it was the first time we ever bought anything on time. But he had for the first time through the Depression, he had a real good job. He was put on at the mill. There wasn't much building, but the mill hired him to, you know, make preformed windows and this kind of thing. And so he was working about 4 months, so Mother and Daddy decided, since we had moved all the way from Texas, that we'd fill in the house. And so we went to the department store, and I think they bought a couple of beds and this dining room table and 6 chairs. And just about 3 months after that, he lost his job. The mill cut back on their orders, and so Dad, as one of the new employees, was let go. And my father, being the kind of man he was, went down to the big department store where we bought the furniture. And he walked into the Mr. Hart, who owned the department store, Hart's department store. And he asked the secretary if he could see Mr. Hart, and he was in his carpenter overalls. And Mr. Hart, you know, said he'd see him, and my dad walked in and explained the situation, that he had bought this furniture in good faith. He thought his job was steady, but now he didn't have a job, but he was sure that in this big store there must be some place. There must be dressing rooms that needed repairing or counters that needed doing. Mm-hmm. And if Mr. Hart could give him a job, he could pay his bills and he would get things done in the store that needed to, and he would pay for the furniture and everybody would be happy. And of course, Mr. Hart got it. So, sometimes when you're writing, it's nice to think about what you're writing about, and you let the words match the feeling of the poem. And this is what I try to do in this. It's, you know, I don't know how successful I was, but I tried to get the cadence of what I'm talking about in the rhythm of the poem. And it's called African Night. Just before sleep, in a lodge on the edge of Lake Kariba in Zimbabwe, in the dark of African night, I feel more than hear, hear without seeing the elephants approach. First a whisper, like leaves in wind, the last sigh before dreams, swish of scythe cutting hay. The elephants come, feeding as they walk, grass torn from soil, uprooted in clumps. Huge trunks sway, seeking shoots of green. Outside the lodge, outside in blackness, a dead branch snaps. Then another, loud and louder, each crack an explosion. I feel more than hear. Hear without seeing the gray shape of fear as elephants pass on the edge of Lake Kariba in Zimbabwe in the dark of African night. So, you know, all I'm really urging you is to play with words. I like this one that Robert wrote on the same trip.
Oh, yeah. You mean
the High Clear Room, yeah.
This is called the High Clear Room of Zimbabwe. It's 60 miles to Mozambique with no walls to block the view. At night, there's a Milky Way for a ceiling, and the Big Dipper is upside down. The man in the moon is a rabbit. The Southern Cross could guide us, but the lodge is just steps away.
No, you don't have to write a lot. You really capture the mood. So I just put that in. Does anybody else have something to share? You know, I wanted to make sure that I didn't leave anybody out. Proving that you can write about anything. I don't know if you will know immediately.
Okay.
Well, I was looking for the... Where is that spelled? Okay, never mind, I'll bring it tomorrow. Oh, there it is. Okay, I'm back. This was really a very strong feeling I had. So, you know, you can record your feelings about all kinds of things. And I actually did give this to my friend to whom I wrote the poem. It's called Words Not Spoken. I regret I did not tell you that I loved your face. Smile wrinkles that etched the corner of each eye. The line between the arch of brows that deepened when you frowned. The scatter of freckles before the days of sunscreen. I even liked the bit of double chin, the soft folds of your neck, which you covered with a scarf, flung on with such panache. Now healed from invasion of the surgeon's knife, you stand before me, wading through my silence. You really do look great. The words are true. But my friend, I miss the dear familiar face I loved. I need a little time to mourn. And, you know, there's a lot of ways of having your best friend. You know, I don't know if it, you know, she got a facelift.
I can relate to that. I had a friend that did the same thing.
Yeah.
I didn't like her at all.
Yeah. This has been my best friend for years. And of course, too, the other sort of thing that stops you is that she's 6 years older than I, and all of a sudden she looked younger. So what would you like, you know, we've had all week, we've done creativity and some personal journaling, talking about memoirs. What I was proposing for tomorrow would be to go back to, you know, to do some more poetry. If you're interested in the four poems, I don't want to bring you things that you don't want. Please keep writing, and in our handout there will be, in fact, I can talk about that, a little assignment. What would you like? What would you like to have for tomorrow? Do you have any feedback on our last day? What would you like to share? And as I say, I'd
like to have Barbara write some more and read to me.
And you know, actually, that really, almost as it stands, would make a really good article to mail to almost any, like Guy Posts or some of the Christian magazines, because you did take a very, you know, definite object and write your feelings around it. And it really was very real.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how she read it without crying.
Yeah. Did your children ever complain about having to dust this dining table? My dad thought that was my job. You know, and it just seemed to take forever to dust that table.
You were there when they had to.
Do you have any feelings? Are you happy to study a little bit about different form poems?
I'd like to see that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. And let's get the hand down. On the second page of your handout are some more of these kind of things, questions. Write what you are willing to discover. What word describes you best? If your life were a movie, what movie would it be? What have you done for love? Who are your heroes and why? What is your pet peeve? Where are you at midnight? Who is your best friend? How many best friends? What was your first job, worst job, gave most joy? What word do you overuse? What one thing about yourself would you change? What do you like about yourself? What won't you leave home without? What one thing about you is unknown to others? What is your favorite childhood memory? What is your personal motto? And what would your epigram read? I wrote one time in junior high school, and it was, "Here lies my little sister, dressed in very best clothes. As in life, so in death, it was my dress she chose." So anyway, that might just spur you to some, you know, about a page of response, and we'll share those in class. I guess this went around, and so that's great. Let's see what we're doing. I said I had a poem here by Merwin, so we'll close with this. And it's called The Unwritten. Inside this pencil crouch words that have never been written, never been spoken, never been thought. Awake in there, dark in the dark, hearing us, but they won't come out. Not for love, not for time, not for fire. Even when the dark has worn away, they'll still be there, hiding in the air. Multitudes in days to come may walk through them, breathe and be none the wiser. What script can it be that they won't unroll? In what language would I recognize it? Would I be able to follow it, to make out the real names of everything? Maybe there aren't many. It could be that there's only one word, and it's all we need. It's here, in this pencil. Every pencil in the world is like this. So find the words in your pencil. Come back tomorrow.
Yeah. Right, any 14
minutes before
lunch? I'm just jotting down ideas because I have no idea. I can do it.
Yes. And there, if you miss any of the handouts, they're on the back table. Thank you all. This is Karen.
What you want to do is read it first. Then it'll get past by the day.
I said, I'm going to go to space. I just, I'm going to go.
awesome.
Wow. What's the advantage of knitting your own stuff? Just to have
it. They feel good and they wear well.
And then pick up two tomorrow then. Oh, I didn't bring them with me today. So pick up an extra one tomorrow. And there's plenty of a lot more.
Yeah. These would be great. Right.
I'll tell her we're sorry that we missed it.
Yes. And I'll share my book with her.
Okay.
Thank you.
I thought we were going to get into the different poultry farms today.
No, tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow.
It was mostly, that's why I asked if, if they wanted it. I was going to make sure. They seemed to say yes. Sorry, I led you astray.
Yeah, because when we talked after class yesterday, you said we're going to cover that tomorrow.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you don't want to...
We may be downstairs.
Well, see me sometime and I'll give you the, if you want that seed drill form, just see me sometime and I'll give it to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and, I'll have my stuff with me at lunchtime probably, unless you're going to, I'll find you sometime, I'll make sure you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I may be here, it depends.
A good day to go to Stehekin's the day you go out.
Oh, because then it's more efficient use of time.
Exactly.
Oh, yes, that's right. Thank you.
Because the day you go out, you usually don't do that much anyway.
Here's a Sistina. This is what I was telling you is the hardest poem I ever wrote.
Oh, yes.
That's the Sistina.
Nice.
You can take that. S-E-S-T-I-N-A.
S-E-S-T-I-N-A.
Now, this is...
what country?
This is Swinburne. This is after Swinburne. This is Swinburne's pattern.
See, this light
here's
as the second.
Oh.
Third, fourth.
It's in a very different...
Rhyming fifth.
Yeah, it's in a very different one. And so you see the same ending, the six rhyme words are all the same. We'll see, uh-huh. Each one repeats. Uh-huh. Each of the six repeat in a different order.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have all six here. You see, there's lights and dyes and skies and nights. And sights and rise.
Oh, I see.
It's not just the one
word.
Wow,
that's
every,
really interesting.
It's every, see, side, anything you'll see is in a different, and it's a very precise order, and this is Swinburne style.
Swinburne.
S-W-I-N-B-U-R-N.
B-O-U-R-N-E.
B-O-U-R-N, that's right.
And what country does this come from?
It's got to be either English or American, because I'm sure it's not a translation.
Yeah, I think he's a... American,
yeah, I think so. I'll look and see if it says in my calibrated. So, as I say, I've written two more since then, but they're really a challenge.
Oh, I can imagine.
And you don't, you have to be so repetitious, and yet you have to keep giving a different thought. I mean, sort of a different slant on it as you go down the page.
Yeah.
Because you can't just keep saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I think probably this was my most successful because I used the thing of the carousel, and so it is repetitious.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like I was talking about the African night poem, the carousel gives itself to repeating, of course, because it goes around and around. It
repeats the lines.
Oh, that's a pantoum.
Pantoum.
Do you know pantoums?
Mm-hmm. No, and the Korean one that you mentioned yesterday.
It's a seed gel. Pantoum is where you have a very...
Use it. First line is the...
I have one here.
I think I'll probably take Marge's suggestion and go to Steve and the day we go out. It'll be more efficient use of the time to do it that way. So that meeting will be here tomorrow.
I was the girl who sang with the band during World War II long ago. We said goodbye and waved a hand, never allowed the tears to show. See, then here's this. During World War II long ago, song for love and dreams to meet truth. We never allowed the tears to show. My sweetheart was killed at 22. Songs were of love and dreams to meet truth. We said goodbye and waved a hand.
Second, fourth, and moves into
the first
and
third. My sweetheart was killed at 22. And then your first line is the same as the first. I was the girl who sang with the band.
And what type of poetry?
It's called a pantoum. P-A-N-T-O-U.
No. Are you going to cover those tomorrow?
Yeah, I'll.
Great. I'd be interested in those.
Robert has
an
interest
in
this. Most of them are mine.
It finally winds up with the inherited horse.
I
just because of the repetition.
Because I play with rhyme so much, most of the pantoums aren't rhyme.
I see.
You know, but it just started because it was about singing with a band and everything. It seemed like it needed, you know, and it was shorter. Some of them will be 5 or 6 verses.
I see.
So
that sounds like a challenge too.
Yeah, that's wonderful on the computer.
Oh yeah, all you gotta do is
it's wonderful on the computer because you can space. You know, space the ones that have to repeat on
the line. Oh, they're part of where it belongs, and then you write it. Right.
So anyway, as you can see, I write all the time about everything. That's a French sonnet, which is a different French sonnet. It's still the 14 lines, but the rhyme scheme is very different, and there's one word line that doesn't rhyme with anything.
I've never done sonnets either. I've done limericks.
Oh, I love limericks.
Yeah.
I won a prize one year. We got a trip to Ireland.
Woo!
To go to Limerick. We had to write limericks using California place names in the limerick. And I wrote them.
Was this brought by the California Chamber of Commerce?
No, it was our local San Jose Mercury News.
Oh, I see.
Mercury, the paper. And it was said Ross, which is, you know, said Ross to the fair Elsinore, Carlsbad. For you, so I implore, get in your coach, Ella. Coachella. Say goodbye to that fella, or else you will see me as I am no more.
Oh, wow.
So, because I love puns.
Yeah.
I play with words all the time.
Yeah. Do you listen to National Public Radio?
Yeah. Harrison Keeler?
Well,
or the other.
There's one that plays with words, is Rewind. That's the recap of the week's news, but there's another one that plays with words. What is it? Oh, it's really good. Obviously, I don't pick it up every week, but I pick it up some.
See, that's the thinking, that one in July. So, I love all kinds of different forms.
Oh, I have to put it in my computer and think of the name of that program that plays with words.
Oh, yeah.
It comes on the weekend. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to have everybody sort of sign a darker ink tomorrow by their...
Oh.
Yeah.
I signed Lynn Lawrence. That's my pen name.
Okay.
That's the name I use for writing movie reviews.
Okay.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Let's see, you repeat them. You can take that back.
Well, I'm not throwing a lot of stuff.
Okay. Do you want to peanut butter sandwich?
I guess we should.
I still have to get your peanut butter sandwich. And then I got some cheating. I all I did was take the bananas.